So our discussion on the roundtable this week is prompted by the arrest. So in May 2020, a man has been arrested for committing an alleged murder in 1988. That's when young American mathematician Scott Johnson died. And his family has campaigned for over 30 years for that death to be recognised as an anti-gay hate crime. And when the charges were laid, the New South Wales Police Commissioner Mick Fuller paid tribute to the family's long-fought campaign for justice. There's much to be proud of in Australia's justice system, but wherever there are humans, there are errors, and errors occur especially when shortcuts are taken, when resources are limited, and when critical roles are understaffed, and when there's prejudice. And what about when police or lawyers just withhold evidence or omit to submit something that might undermine the case? Errors in justice, of course, have profound effects, and their victims, in the very broadest sense, have long and extraordinarily difficult journeys. And we thought for today's roundtable, we would invite three people who've been involved in different ways in very long campaigns for justice. So joining us is first Dr. Bob Moles, who's adjunct principal researcher at Flinders University, as well as the founder of the Networked Knowledge Project. And Bob is known for his expertise in the area of miscarriages of justice. Welcome to Sunday Extra, Bob Moles.
Thanks, Julian. Good to be with you.
Great to have you. And we're also joined by Mark Leveson. Mark is the father of Matthew Leveson, who disappeared from a nightclub in 2007. Welcome to the program, Mark.
Thanks, Julian. Good morning, all.
Good morning. And Michelle Reuters is Associate Dean of Criminology and Justice Studies and the Director of Bridge of Hope and Innocence Initiative at RMIT. Welcome also, Michelle.
Thank you, Julian. Good morning.
Great. Now, Bob Moles, if I could start with you, could you just tell us about how you came to be interested in the issue of miscarriages of justice and the work that you've done to try and correct some of the errors that our justice system has made?
Yes, of course. In the year 2000, I was working with students at Adelaide University, and we were working on a number of projects, community projects, get the students involved in some sort of practical learning. And one of the solicitors asked us to have a look at the case of Henry Keogh. I didn't know anything about it at the time, but he suggested that it was a case involving a wrongful conviction. And so we set about having a look at the as to whether or not it was, in fact, a potential wrongful conviction case. It turned out that we thought it was. And then we began to explore ways in which we could get it back to the courts. And that led us into a growing realisation that the Australian legal system is not very congenial in terms of reviewing potential wrongful conviction cases. Mm. And it took us, to cut a long story short, it took us 13 years of basically wrangling with the legal system to even get anyone to actually hear the claims that we had that Mr. Keogh's case was wrongful conviction. Ultimately, we had to develop legislation to change the appeal rights in Australia to create a new right of appeal. That was the first change to the appeal rights in Australia in over 100 years. And then when his case came back for hearing before the Court of Appeal, they did recognise that it was a miscarriage of justice and set aside his conviction.
Michelle Reuters, these sort of innocent projects, there has been a huge sort of a proliferation of them around the world. How effective have these sorts of projects been generally? And can you tell us about Bridge of Hope specifically?
Yes. Well, there's certainly been a proliferation in America, which is where the movement started.
Yeah.
There's only a handful of projects in Australia, and I think that's probably largely because it hasn't been taken up by universities and other organisations in a wholesale way. Certainly America's had a lot of success, but I think only one project in Australia has been associated with a successful outcome. And I can tell you that's not due to the want of trying. It's just that, as Bob's alluded to, there are enormous roadblocks in the way to having matters reinvestigated and bringing them back before the courts. And as you can imagine, in some cases, there are masses of material and, you know, these need a microscopic look to find out, you know, what kind of error could have occurred at what point. Our project started 5 or 6 years ago when we were approached by the Bridge of Hope Foundation, which is a Melbourne-based charity, to start the project up. And it really was a no-brainer because it brought together the opportunity to educate students about the prevalence of errors in the system, and ideally send out well-educated practitioners in their different fields. But also, gave us probably one of the few opportunities to spend the time getting to the bottom of, what happened in this particular case, why this miscarriage of justice and why this happened.
Thanks for giving us that outline. I'd like to come to you now, Mark Leveson, and obviously your connection with Long Fights for Justice is such a personal one. You lost your son, Matthew, who disappeared from a nightclub in 2007. Can you tell us a little bit about the circumstances of Matthew's disappearance and your advocacy for him and for justice after that tragic event?
Sure. Back in September 2007, our middle son Matthew went missing from the Ark nightclub in Sydney. That's where he was last seen. And after a week of investigation, it really turned into a murder hunt. And ultimately, about 11 months later, his then boyfriend was charged with his murder. He stayed in custody, not applying for bail, and about a year further down the track, he was tried for Matt's murder and manslaughter. After about a six-week trial and 5 days of deliberation, the jury found him not guilty of both, nor murder nor manslaughter. Then with the criminal justice system concluded basically at that point, it was up to us to fight for him because Matt couldn't speak for himself. Mm. So we pushed and pushed for further investigation, for inquest, and it wasn't really until December 15 when an inquest started into Matt's death. And that took 2 years, that inquest, sitting sporadically over the two-year period. And evidence before the inquest, his then partner who had been charged was compelled to testify in the inquest, and after a series of deals and concessions being made to him, he gave the authorities the location of where he placed Matt's body in 2007.
And that was something that was obviously crucially important to you, was to be able to bring Matthew's remains home. But to do that, you were faced with what you described as an impossible choice. Can you tell us what that was?
Sure. There were three stages to this. In the Crail Act in New South Wales, under Section 61, if a person is compelled to give evidence by the coroner, and they do, what they say can't be used against them in a further murder or manslaughter trial. That's number one. So we accepted that. And after Atkins being forced to testify, he did appeal through the Supreme Court to not testify and lost the appeal. But after 5 days in the box, we realised we were going nowhere. We were getting no results and going really circular with the evidence that he was giving. So the police had the idea, look, we might offer a further deal where he's given immunity from all charges, including contempt of court and perjury, because he did admit to lying to the police and the coroner if he gave us Matt's remains. And we deliberated on that all weekend and agreed to that. But then there was a further deal done, which we weren't aware of, with the then police police commissioner, head of homicide, I should say, that he was given immunity from also every charge, including interfering with a corpse, which we thought we might have had him on. And after that being done, he gave police an induced statement giving us all the details of where to find Matt.
Mm, mm. So you've been quoted as saying that it's not a justice system, it's just a system. Can you tell us what you mean by that?
That is also a tattoo on my left arm. It's there for good, and it means a lot. We've found going through the justice system, it may be called justice, but really we felt as victims we were treated as second-class citizens. We didn't matter. Everything through the court process, particularly the criminal trial, everything favoured the accused. See, in the criminal trial, the Evidence Act applies, which didn't in the inquest process. But in the Evidence Act, which the layperson doesn't see, a good quarter to a third of the time was spent with the legal people arguing over what evidence could and couldn't be heard. And in most cases, the judge, Justice Hidden, conceded to the requests of the defence side. And we just felt that we were, or poor Matt was left without a voice through that process.
Yes, indeed. Thank you for outlining that for us, Mark. If I could come back to you now, Dr. Bob Moles. When you talked about how you managed to achieve some changes, legislative changes that helped with dealing with miscarriages of justice where people have been convicted. Is it possible to sort of give us an anatomy of how you go about trying to redress a miscarriage of justice like this? Because in a way, you have to use the system that has miscarried in a way. How do you go about that task?
Look, it is extremely difficult because the system has inbuilt sort of impulses, as it were, not to own up to having made errors. One of the major problems that we had was that we discovered that the person who was the chief forensic pathologist in South Australia, appointed in 1968, and then in the mid-70s, his employer told the Supreme Court that he wasn't actually qualified to certify cause of death and that he wasn't actually qualified as an expert, which meant he couldn't give expert evidence in court. Mm. But then they continued for the next 20 years to instruct him to do autopsies. He did ended up doing 10,000 autopsies, even though he wasn't qualified to do them. And they then used him to secure over 400 criminal convictions, even though he wasn't entitled to appear in court as an expert witness. In July, 2 years ago, the Attorney General said on ABC Radio that she recognised that, in fact, he wasn't qualified and that his evidence was manifestly inadequate, such that convictions couldn't be maintained on the basis of it. And yet even today, when appeals come up, the prosecution still maintains before the Court of Appeal that his evidence is in fact reliable and convictions can be maintained on the basis of it. Now, of course, the prosecution has a duty to ensure the court is fully informed of any potential defects in the Crown case. So on the one hand, we have an attorney telling the public that his evidence is inherently unreliable and you can't uphold convictions on the basis of it, whilst at the same time the prosecutors are going into court and saying, no, it's all perfectly all right, there's nothing wrong with the evidence, uphold this conviction. In Britain, if I could just mention briefly, they had a Criminal Review Commission, which was set up in 1997, and that's an independent body that examines whether there's evidence to establish a wrongful conviction. And since then, they've identified 450 cases where the court has accepted that there are wrongful convictions. They've overturned, amongst that, 100 cases involving murder convictions, and four people who were hanged had their convictions overturned. Mm. Canada and New Zealand have also in the process of establishing criminal review commissions, and we have argued that all states should now introduce the new right of appeal that we have in South Australia. It was introduced in Tasmania and Victoria, but the other states haven't done it yet. And Michael Kirby, the former Justice of the High Court, has written an article in the Criminal Law Journal pleading that all the states to adopt a new right of appeal and to establish a national criminal review commission. And in his article, he says the problem with Australia is that they are so behind other countries in being willing to tackle this aspect of the problem.
Michelle Reuters, would you agree that Australia is lagging behind in this area? And I wanted to get your thoughts also on the question that Bob sort of alluded to there, which is the role of public opinion in these miscarriage of justice cases and how important work through, say, the media or political advocacy can be.
Yes, like I would certainly agree with Bob that we're behind the rest of the world who have made great developments in this area. We're constantly looking to what's happening in the UK, but not necessarily learning from their experiences or putting those in place. For example, there were several inquiries into the extent of and the prevalence of non-disclosure in the UK. And we've had several cases in Australia, but the same sort of lens of scrutiny hasn't been raised here, which I think is certainly going to be problematic and has been an issue in a number of the cases that we've investigated. Public opinion, you only have to look at, Lindy Chamberlain's case and the Kelly Lane case to see how not necessarily influential public opinion can be, but how divisive public opinion can be in this area. I forgot the tail end of your question there relating to the media.
Well, no, it's just a question of, this involves taking on a challenge which might be quite unpopular in the early stages. So I'm interested in how innocent projects go about trying to change public opinion sometimes, or whether it's about kind of defying public opinion and trying to make coming up with a legal strategy that might be able to correct things.
Yeah, absolutely. We've investigated a few, high-profile cases where the media has been crucial to putting a focus on the mistakes that happened in these cases and ideally, tending to work towards some kind of outcome. But in taking these cases on, you have to maintain absolute objectivity. Otherwise, we end up suffering the same problems that investigators do, which is developing tunnel vision about what we expect to find. And it's really difficult. We're all human. You alluded to this at the beginning. This is all about human error. And even though we've been doing this quite a while, it is really difficult to take on a case that it has been notorious and not have, preconceived ideas about what happened and put that to one side and then, get down to the basis of factual investigation about what actually happened here. And so many times, when you get into the thick of it and you speak to the person, and sometimes this is the first time that person's voice has been heard. This is the first time they've managed to get their story, communicated to anyone other than their defence lawyer. And it completely, it turns round any, preconception you had about the case. So from our perspective, it really is about putting aside every emotion, every opinion, every other aspect that can persuade you in a particular direction, and sitting down and looking at, what actually happened? What can we work out actually happened in this case? Where were the mistakes? Where did the... at what point did the police investigation turn in this direction, and what made it turn, and what maybe did they leave behind and not investigate?
Mark Levinson, what was your experience in terms of dealing with the media during your advocacy for a different outcome in terms of the disappearance and death of your son, Matthew?
The media were great. We were told early on by the investigating police before the criminal trial at different times, at this point, don't talk to the media. At this point, you can tell them this, or at this point, say nothing, be very close guard, or you can tell them a lot. And they use the media as a tool, but the media understood that, because often outside court, particularly at trial time, we'd have questions and we'd say to the media, look, I'm sorry, we can't discuss it today. And they understood that. So we were never rude. And over the years, we fostered a lot of good friendships with many versions of media, radio, TV, print media. And we see some of them socially today. There's some good people there. And they did help us, because when we're pushing to have an inquest, to have investigations restarted, they did help our cause. Even if I could go on, please, to the reward process. We applied for a reward before the inquest started. We had one already for $100,000. We applied for it, we doubled to $200,000. And this process is a long, hard process. Mm. We were informed by our lead detective after the inquest started. He had made just a passing comment. You know, gee, it was a shame about the reward. And we said, what do you mean shame? He said, well, you got knocked back. Haven't you been told? We weren't. And we were quite furious. So we wrote to the then police commissioner and received an apology, but it didn't help our cause. Mm. But during the second crime scene search for Matt, of which there was three, there was a lot of media coverage for Matt's investigation and searches. So we thought, well, let's use the profile of what's going on. So we sent an open letter to the police minister asking for the reward to be increased to $250,000. That wasn't long after they gave a million to William Tyrrell. So within 16 hours, the minister rang me personally and said, you've got your reward. Right, because so the media were hounding him as to what are you going on with this, what's going on with this Leveson case. So, you know, the power of the media can be quite profound.
And yeah, and clearly can cut more than one way. Dr. Bob Moles, if I could come back to you now, you're one of the cases that you're now working on is the case of Derek Blomley. Can you give us an outline of his situation? I suppose when we get to the end of that, is what is it that gives you the will to keep carrying on with this, with what looks like a very, very tough situation for Derek Blomley?
Yeah, just as an introduction to that, Julian, could I mention that the media we have always regarded as being extremely important. We've done roughly over 130 TV and radio programmes, which are available from our website. And in October 2001, it was the ABC Four Corners programme that did an extensive programme about the problems with our forensic pathologist and a series of other cases. With all of these cases, including Mr. Bromley's case, they almost invariably involve horrific circumstances, which often explains why they become miscarriages of justice, because the police and investigators are very keen to reassure the public that, in fact, they're on the case and they're going to get it solved and the public mind can be put at rest. So as soon as somebody's arrested, we tend to forget about the presumption of innocence and think that everything's okay. With Mr. Bromley, it was alleged that he had been involved in an altercation down on the river here in Adelaide. He got involved in a bit of a punch-up. It was said that he'd thrown the body in the river and it was recovered from there about 5 days later. The evidence given at his trial was really in two parts. One was from an eyewitness who said he saw Mr. Bromley conduct the assault, and, of course, our forensic pathologist who said the injuries were consistent with being assaulted at or about the time of death and that he died from drowning. As to the eyewitness, there were five experts on his appeal who said that the eyewitness, it was acknowledged that he was suffering from a psychotic condition on the night that the incident occurred, and where he was having both visual and audible hallucinations. But the Crown reassured the jury that despite that, his observations about what Mr. Bromley did could well be reliable.
And those appeals still were unsuccessful.
Yeah, the five experts on the appeal said that that's not correct, because when you've got such a severe psychotic condition, nothing the witness says could be held to be reliable. And then there were three additional experts who said the pathology evidence would not be reliable because Dr. Manners didn't know how to diagnose a drowning case. And in many respects, the evidence that they gave, two of the experts on Mr. Bromley's appeal were the same experts who gave almost exactly similar evidence on Mr. Keogh's appeal, because they both involved drowning cases. And they said that the drowning case is a diagnosis of exclusion, so you have to do a complete autopsy in order to exclude any other possible cause of death before you can know it's a drowning. And the court accepted their evidence in the Keogh case, but in the Bromley case, the court didn't accept the evidence, or rather they accepted the evidence that said it didn't really matter, and they even refused him leave to appeal. So despite the fact that he had eight experts saying the evidence of his trial was misleading and incorrect, the Court of Appeal still rejected his appeal. It's interesting to know that Mr. Bromley's been in prison for 37 years, which is an extraordinary length of time. And he's now 12 years beyond his non-parole period. And the reason for that is because when you get to the end of your non-parole period, and the parole board asks you how you feel about what you did, if you say, I wasn't there and I didn't do it, it suggests that you haven't been suitably reformed and they won't allow you to be released on parole. So in effect, the life sentence then becomes a whole of life sentence.
Look, unfortunately, we're getting very close to time, but if I could just turn one final time to Michelle Reuters. Michelle, you're seeking a pardon in the Khalid Baker case. Where is that at, and what are the prospects, do you think, of getting a pardon?
We want to hope that they were reasonable. Khalid's case has now been taken up by a group of lawyers who I believe are investigating the new further rights of appeal legislation as another option. This was an extraordinary case. Just a bit of brief background. This is a case where Khalid was convicted of murder. There was a co-accused who made admissions to police and to other witnesses at the time, but this co-accused was acquitted. And this person subsequently has come out in the media and acknowledged responsibility for the event. And it really is an extraordinary situation. But it's when we were talking about human error, this is a classic case of witness misidentification, where there were two groups of witnesses. One group was white, one group was black. The white witnesses identified Khalid as the assailant, even though they hadn't seen him before. And there were all sorts of factors which meant that identification were unreliable, such as drugs, alcohol, dim lighting. Lack of familiarity was the black witnesses who knew who was in the vicinity and, were able to say, well, no, it was actually the other person.
All right. And well, so look, unfortunately, Michelle, we are going to have to leave it there because we're running out of time. Thank you very much to Dr. Bob Moles, Mark Leveson and Michelle Reuters for that discussion. And we really appreciate the efforts that you've all made to the very long campaigns for justice. Thanks for joining us on Sunday Extra.
You're welcome. Thank you all and goodbye.